Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Steve Tonella, who is a generational vineyardist. We're talking 100 years. This is serious, guys. I've tasted his wines, the Tonella Cellars, as Hart Tonella to be exact, brand for a number of years. I've been continuously impressed. I finally get to sit down with Steve and indulge in learning about him, his brand, his vision. And I invite you to join in the conversation. You can write an email. But meanwhile, let's start and find out where you born. Where were you born, excuse me? And where did it all begin for you?
I was born at the St. Helena Sanitarium, so not too far from here.
That's quite close. We're in Rutherford, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I was born there, and my first time back there was harvest of last year because something fell on my head, and I had to get stitches, so... That was the first time I went back there since I was born. Not too far from here in Rutherford.
How about that? So you were born right smack in the middle of the wine country.
Yep, absolutely.
More perfect. So do you have a large family?
It's not a large family. It's pretty small by Italian standards. So one sister and my parents are here. And my mom lives in Sonoma. Mm-hmm. We're all Northern California based and pretty much close by.
Yes. And your family had vineyards.
Yeah. My great uncle was the first one that came over here. He came over after the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, and they were advertising for workers on every major European publication. So he read that, and you know, it was a new world, new experience, new adventure. So he came over, just worked a few months in San Francisco, and I think he had a relative up here in Napa Valley. Met him, and the next day he met somebody from Beaulieu Vineyards, and this was in January 1907, and the next day he started working there, and he struck up a conversation with George Latour, the original owner of BV, because my uncle spoke French. He worked in Switzerland, and they always speak a lot of languages over there. So yeah, he got on really well with George Latour, and ended up being at Beaulieu for 43 years, was their first winemaker. Probably was equivalent to what you might call a COO today. He did the winemaking, hired, make sure everybody got paid, ran the logistic and G&A and winery staff. So he pretty much did everything during those years.
So BV, which years, which time frame in history?
So pre-prohibition, so that was 1907 to about 1950.
So that's pre-Andrei Chelyshev?
Yeah, so he hired Andrei Chelyshev.
Okay.
He had the entry into the World's Fair, I think, in 1939.
That is so seminal because 76, a lot of people know about Judgment Fairs. Big deal, right? But there was the World Fair in Paris where BV did quite well, didn't it?
Yeah. And here they had the World's Fair here in San Francisco as well, and they got the top honors. And it's viewed as one of the iconic wines in the history of Rutherford, but they don't note him as much. His name was Joseph Ponti.
Joseph Ponti. You guys can do some research on that.
Joseph Ponti, yeah. And he, actually, this lane up here off it where this interview is off of Skellinger Lane, but
yep.
Ponti Road is the next road, crossroad of here. And it was named after him. And he initially acquired these vineyards, about 55 acres. It was about 35, I think, initially. And he worked with George Latour and acquired all these vineyards, and they parceled them out. So we're right next to George III, which is Beckstoffer's. But my great uncle planted all these with George Latour and his team.
Well, this is as deep of a history as there is. I mean, we're talking 43 years, like you said, pre-Chelyshev era, making this. I mean, people mistakenly think that Napa Valley just started with Mondavi, and it really did not.
Yeah, there's several phases, for sure. There's pre-prohibition, there's Phloxera.
Yep.
And so, yeah, the Rutherford did really well, specifically Beaulieu during Prohibition.
Yeah.
Because they George Latour had he was very religious, and he had a very close relationship with the diocese archbishop of the local area. So they had, I want to say they had a really good market share. They increased over 400% in terms of total production during Prohibition. So, yeah, a few of them survived through Sacramento wines and other things, but yeah.
That's quite a powerful statement right there, because again, BV at the time was it. Really, I mean, there were Christian Brothers and such like that, but BV was really making very significant wines for quite a number of decades, really. And then when Chelyuchov came along, he elevated it almost exponentially, especially for that time frame.
Yeah, he definitely modernized it. You know, introduced stainless steel, and you know, there's an art and a science to wine, and he was definitely the science.
Yeah,
and really developed a lot of great things for the valley. You know, if you look at just trying to get French oak during World War II, you just couldn't get it. So there's a lot of challenges and growing up that had to be done. And, you know, he definitely brought it into a new era.
Yes. No, there's never enough credit, in my view, that could be given to this man.
Yeah.
His name is woven into every conversation. Wherever it starts, somehow there's a touch point where he comes up. So just want to make a note of that, because if you guys don't know who Andrew Chelyuchov is, please, if you're any kind of an aficionado or even a beginner for wine, he is the foundational piece of Napa Valley and actually other wine regions as well. So 55 acres were purchased in Rutherford. And do you farm?
These are the
in Rutherford still?
This is, you know, under the control of my father.
Okay.
Historically, we do have my vineyard's just off of Nibom Lane, so that we're in kind of central eastern Rutherford right now, and the Nibom property is Rutherford Bench, so a little bit different type of soil, a little bit more gravelly, well drained, alluvial fan off the mountains there. So yeah, it's a vertical cordon vineyard that is all farmed by hand. So yeah, we manage the energy of each vine, and you know, two French Bordeaux clones that are not widely planted outside of Bordeaux, and you know, vines are about 21 years old, so you know, very healthy, limited production winery and vineyard.
Yes, no, I can attest to that, because I've tested the final product many times, and quality through the roof. Let's go back in time a little bit and talk about, you were born in St. Helena, you went to high school locally, correct?
Yeah, I went to high school my parents split up, so I went to high school in Sebastopol.
Okay, that's Sonoma.
Yep, in Sonoma, yep. So I was always back and forth here all my life, and, you know, in the vineyard since I was 6 years old, and, you know, started making wine in the 90s, and I say I went pro in 2010 because that was my first release, but...
Did you go to school was your college years affected by the viticultural?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I went to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, so I majored in business and graduated with a business degree. But I would say most of what I learned is in the vineyards and through mentors. And yeah, I got a degree at UC Davis as well for viticulture.
Wow, so helpful, but you said practical experience irreplaceable. Did you always know that you would be in viticulture and winemaking?
Yeah, I mean, I always knew I wanted to be a part of it. I think when you grow up here, it's beautiful, it's lovely. But in the end, it's, you know, today it's about 114,000 people. It's probably growing with all the construction I've seen in Napa and American Canyon. But when you're young, and the average age is about 65, you probably don't, I didn't at least appreciate it as much. So you definitely want to get out and see the world. So. You know, that's what I did, and you know, extensive time, had a day job, you know, trying to work I'm self-funded, so this winery project is self-funded, so.
Oh, we got to talk about that.
Yeah.
There you are with such an intense background.
Yeah.
And so much, you know, exposure, you know, historically, I'm sure that you heard stories from a very early age, what it was like. So you chose to study, you know, Cal Poly and UC Davis, two schools where you want to go if you're going to go into the wine business. But you said you left at some point to explore the world and kind of get to know yourself a little bit. Where did you go?
So post Cal Poly, I went to Japan.
Oh, that's kind of different.
Yeah,
it's not a wine country.
No, it's not wine country. It was after a big earthquake, and I minored in construction management, so there's opportunity to help rebuild. So I ended up volunteering, but then, you know, started actually working there and, you know, helped rebuild commercial and residential areas. In terms, I had a project management position. So I did that for about a year and then came back and got into high tech. So I was, you know, my business degree, and I had a lot of friends in the high tech world. Mm-hmm. And so I was based in Palo Alto. You know, always came back here for the harvest and things like that, but, you know, really worked on a day job. And eventually I worked for a company that transferred me over to Europe. So I was actually 10 years in Europe.
Where?
Three and a half years in Rome, and then the remainder in Barcelona.
Not bad. Those are beautiful cities.
Yeah, I negotiated well for just based on climate and culture. So, yeah, it was a really great experience. You know, I was back and forth here. I was actually doing the wine project, you know, back and forth. So it was a limited start, but, you know, quality above all else. And you know, I really waited for the vineyard to get in balance.
So I'm just picturing there you were, construction to high tech. The glamour of European living, because that's a whole other piece. You know, I'm sure it had influence on you, because how can it not?
Sure.
Lifestyle in Europe was way different. What were you doing in high tech, by the way? What was your...
I was a sales leader, so sales and operations. I led teams all over Europe, Middle East, Africa, and South America.
So pretty intense and, you know, detailed and...
A lot of travel.
Yeah. So, and then... You wind up back here.
Yeah, it wasn't like a light switch. Like, it didn't change. Yeah. It was a kind of a gradual change, you know, in terms of the planting the vineyard, in terms of, you know, getting the, you know, I've made all my wines for over 7 years before putting them in the bottle, testing different vineyards, different clones, different oak programs, you know, different treatments. So, you know, it took a lot of thought and a lot of work to get where I know the vineyards and the fruit that we source from growers that we've known for generations, to be able to have a kind of a platform or baseline to be able to grow off of. And that's where I'm at now.
So your family still had vineyard presence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what you described early in the conversation. Mm-hmm. How many acres exactly?
Here is 55, and over at Nibom it's equivalent to 3.5.
Okay, and that was your partial fruit source. You said you were experimenting with other fruit sources. And
yep, so I experimented with other growers that we've known, specifically in Rutherford, in Oakville, and Stag's Leap.
Okay. So why weren't you not all in to begin with? Like, and that's not that's not a characterization, it's just... You obviously had this connection from the beginning. And mm-hmm. I know you went off and did what I think is really healthy to get to know who you are in different realms.
Yeah.
But you were still very much, you know, attached and involved in the family business, right?
Yeah, it was just a matter of timing, you know. I mean, my dad was really running it. My grandfather worked on these vineyards until he was, I think, 80 plus years old.
Okay.
So it was just, like you said, just to get out and see the world and kind of prove myself in another discipline and gain that type of experience and that business experience that I think is, you know, serving me well now.
Of course. And did you always know in the back of your mind that this is where you're going to wind up?
Yeah, I think it was just timing. Exactly.
And I would just highlight the business experience piece because, you know, Napa Valley really is still a small business country. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of corporate ownership, but at the heart of it, and the business aspect of it, is so important, especially in a competitive market. And the fact that you took this upon yourself early on to gain that experience and that confidence, I think, like you said, it serves you well now, because you understand other aspects besides wine, grape growing and winemaking. And that's a piece that doesn't get discussed enough, I think. Because it's, you know, we like to romanticize things and we think that wine just shows up and sells itself. That's not exactly the case, is it? So I just want to validate that you have crafted your path very, very smartly.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it's, I don't think there's one way to do it. There's no silver bullet. I think there's a lot of, you know, multi-generational and maybe even first-generational vintners that are really trying to be, you know, tell their story and be authentic. And I think there's room for everyone, but you know, there's people that maybe have a little bit bigger bankroll that come in here where maybe profit isn't, you know, the first priority, or you know, maybe it's a hobby or things like that. But you know, you really have to, if it's for profit and it's your own money, you know, you're out there hustling, and you know, it's really exciting. It can be really frustrating, but you kind of just have to find your own path and have a few good mentors to kind of guide. But in the end, it's your trial and error to a large extent.
And with such an extraordinary background, you know, in your back pocket, having that acreage and having that presence in the valley, you still had to do everything that everybody else is subject to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the name helps so much. I always go back to the reference of Napa Valley's 114,000 people. So, you know, maybe a few friends and family knew about us, but we were growers. I mean, I'm the first one who actually put the wine out under our own label. And that takes, you know, you have to start from a few friends and family, which only goes so far, which is great. You have a built-in fan base, but after that, you really have to create the market, basically.
It's absolutely fascinating, because you think, again, that with the name recognition and being known for quality and presence in the valley, it'd just be a piece of cake. But no, you have to prove yourself at every stage of this. You said you experimented quite a bit with different clonal selections, different sites. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that like, this formative years? You know,
I'm a little bit biased, so other people can discount my comments a little bit, but I'm biased towards Rutherford, first of all. I think, you know, it's just the terroir and the warm days, cool evenings, the soil types, you know, not too warm, not too cold, just right. Of course, Mother Nature always has a say in that. So I think Oakville as well is premium area, and I think Stag's Leap, you know, a lot of the hillside, you know, fruit is great, and it's a great appellation. So those are the three concentrated appellations, and then, you know, it's for the different varieties of Sauvignon Blanc, it's testing all the different clones, different parts of the vineyards. You know, there's so many microclimates, but there's also a lot of different soil types, even within a small area, call it a 10-acre vineyard. So being able to source from different sections, not the rows, a lot of people source from rows, we can actually put our arms around a corner or a section of a vineyard and influence the way it's farmed and you know, certainly see how it, you know, bears in terms of the vinification process. So it was basically just experimentation, different clones, different soil types, you know, different oak programs. We ended up making a specific type of barrel with a cooper for our Sauvignon Blanc program. So, you know, I think it was just a lot of, you know, one, knowing the vineyards and the health of the vineyards, two, being able to manage the quality and the farming decisions to a large extent, and three, just trialing. You know, first year is always a get to know you period, and then this, you know, you can iterate on the quality and the harvest decisions and things like that. So also the oak programs, I mean, in terms of toast levels, in terms of forests, in terms of duration. You know, a lot of people probably think they already know that and can produce good wine, but you know, if we can get the last, you know, 5 or 10% right, and it can create a synergy, then you know, there's hopefully a method to the madness.
So first of all, I'm hearing that you're saying there's no shortcut. Just because you think that certain cooperages work with certain varietal, you know, it doesn't mean that that's actually going to happen. So you have to start from the beginning every time, which is time-consuming, expensive. But you have to go through this if you truly aspire to produce quality. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that, for me, that's it. Quality above all else. You know, some people ask me, how do you set your prices? I said quality above all else. And, you know, when you put that effort into it, I think it produces the finished wine that distinguishes you or any winery from others. And, you know, I'll just say, you know, play the devil's advocate, you know, it may come out the way you like it, but it's not exactly, and maybe some people can't tell, but you can tell, and eventually it's going to show itself, right? You know, with the absence of faults, it's all stylistic, right? So my goal is to make it the wine that's the truest expression of the vineyard up until the harvest time. Right.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I think everybody would agree that we drink better today than we ever have. Mm. So the quality has risen exponentially across the board. And certainly with respect specifically to Napa Valley, a lot of good wine is being made here. And conversely, at similar price points. So how do you stand out? How do you make your wine have that voice in the marketplace? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the most scalable method in the world, but I go out and present everywhere I go.
Yeah.
So as the owner, proprietor, somebody who's in the vineyards to making the wine, to presenting the wine, I think people appreciate that story, and hopefully they can taste, they can connect the story with the wine.
Yeah.
And judge the merits of wines on merit of the wine on its own, but connect it with that story. And that's what gets people excited about, you know, presenting wine to their clients, right? So it's really a hand sell in a lot of places, but, you know, wherever I go, I do, you know, I'm 90% allocated direct, so I get to tell that story at wine dinners and a few selected events, one that we saw each other at last week. And so those are the ways I connect with people. And then after that, it's word of mouth.
And we'll definitely go back to 90% allocated direct. Okay. That's a dream comment for a lot of wineries. But just to go back to the Rutherford piece, I know your family has land here, and clearly, you know, you've been known as a highly desirable grower. But you didn't choose Rutherford because you're already established. You chose Rutherford for other reasons, which is important to point out, because you had choices. You could have sourced grapes for your brand elsewhere. I'm sure you've had connections and such like
that.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
But Rutherford is a very special place for you. Tell us why in more detail.
I mean, just it's a heritage. I have nothing to do with that. I'm lucky to have that type of lineage and heritage here. So there's a little bit of sentimental attached. So again, I'm probably biased, so people can discount. But I think it's the ideal for growing Bordeaux grapes and probably other varieties. Yeah, I'm convinced it is. There's just something about it. Specifically, the Rutherford bench is very distinct and. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't tasted anything quite like it. Other people have. Other people, including Psalms, know a lot more about wine than I do. But I know, a lot about a few things. And Rutherford's one of them. It's pretty much the widest part of Napa Valley. It's the center. You know, it has, 3% of the world is Mediterranean climate. This is one area where we do have Mediterranean climate. And I think it's a perfect balance. You're not in Carneros with the more of a maritime climate. And you're not in Calistoga with a little bit warmer climate. It's temperate, full, you know, it's dead center of the valley, most, ambient sunlight in the valley, and definitely get that warm days and cool evenings for ripening, and just the soil types are perfectly matched. So
it's that Goldilocks effect.
Yeah. Not to this, not to that, not just to right. This. But, I mean, I think every sub-appellation of Napa Valley has their strengths, certainly their advocates. I mean, it's probably just because I come from here, I'm a little bit more biased, but I think, you know, the quality is quality above all else, and I think that resonates for, and is true for other appellations as well.
Is there such a thing as Rutherford dust, or is it just a term?
I mean, it's a term, and I think it does exist. I think both probably. A lot of people associate it with maybe fine tannins or, you know, lingering fine tannins, but I think it really, Schellenchef didn't coin it. I think it was somebody before him from UC Davis. And I think it's just that terroir that comes out in the glass. And I think it's just a distinct, it's mainly a terroir comment.
Okay.
But it's something that manifests itself, you know, in the glass, specifically with Cabernet.
So there's a distinguishable piece to that.
I think
it's
so.
It's not just... How do you define terroir?
It's everything. It's soil, it's climate, it's microclimate, it's exposure, all the things that, you know, revolve around the vines, right?
Is there a human piece to it as well?
I think there's a human piece to it, and yeah, I think it's, you know, don't mess it up. And of course, you have to cultivate the vines. I mean, there's a lot of conventional farmers. There's a lot of organic farmers. And I think, you know, everyone just has to, you know, goal is to produce the best possible fruit they can. Sometimes you can argue growers may go for something else. But I think in the end, it's quality above all else.
You have such a deep background in farming. Do you have any staunch beliefs in any specific point of view, whether it's biodynamic, organic, you know, some type of sustainable. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I like sustainable a lot. We're sustainable. It's not cost effective for a larger commercial vineyard unless they're charging Napa Valley average plus 100% or something, because we do it by hand. It's artisan. You know, you get those people in northern Italy that are still hand sewing ties and clothes, silk scarves, things like that. And then you get really good quality products that are manufactured elsewhere. I don't discount or I don't critique conventional farming. I think there's a way to do it responsibly. My vineyard is actually organic, but we can't call ourselves organic just because of the surrounding vineyard. But I think you really have to, cultivate the best expression of a vineyard, you really need to take care of it. And sometimes conventional farming can push and stress grapes a little bit too much. So then they have to pull them after 17, 18 years. But if you farm them organically, you don't stress them out too much with too heavy of a crop. Then you can get a longer, gestation or age of your vines, which I think overall is more beneficial, right? Because when you pull them out, you wait 3+ years.
Yeah.
And a lot of costs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's economics, and I'm sure that there's some relationship with the land as well of what mm-hmm. it's like to continuously being, What is your perspective in general? You said that you were hand farming your vineyard. Mm-hmm. Is it something that's a necessity in your case, or is it something that you choose to do for the reasons you just described?
I mean, what's really necessary these days? I think it does add an element of health to the vines when you can judge something that's a little less vigorous or not. Mm-hmm. And you can prune it differently. You can manage the canopy differently. You can manage the crop load based on the health of the vigor of the vine. I don't have an orientation with my vines. People say, oh, my orientation's north, south, east, west. My vines are vertical cordon, which is it's like head trained. It's a very traditional way to farm, and it's not done very much anymore. But, we actually manage the canopy in the morning side different than the afternoon side. If it's a younger vine, an older vine, we make sure there's sunflex and not direct sunlight on the fruit. So, I would say it's that extra touch, it's that extra bit of care for the vines that are going to help them produce the best quality fruit. So I think I don't think it's a necessity. I think it definitely adds something to the final product.
It sounds like a very sensible approach. Like, it's really driven.
It makes sense, but if you have somebody with a 25, 50 acre vineyard to do what we do, their farming costs would go, through the roof.
Yeah.
So it's nice to be able to do that, and it's nice to be able to have the size of vineyard we do and a manageable, a manageable vineyard. We have a family that helps us, they're a Mexican American family who helps us with the farming, and, labor here is very hard, and so we have the ability to time things when we want them. One example is we prune in generally in March. A lot of people start pruning in December or January. Sometimes it's due to availability of labor. I like to prune in March because the vines are waking up, so they heal faster, the bud break is later, the fruit sets later, and then the harvest is later, and I get to take advantage of those more temperate months of September or October, so the fruit ripens a little bit slowly. So that's just one example. And there's a thousand things that go up until the time of the harvest, which again, if you can get everything up right up until the harvest correct and get the fruit in when you want it, I think that's 90% of winemaking in a good year.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's so many, many minute decisions that go into it that, are not appreciable to a layperson.
But, right.
I've talked to a lot of really renowned viticulturalists, and they've cited at one time or the other that they can look at the vineyard and sort of take its temperature, assess the health mm-hmm. of, it's not really one specific practice or the other. They just know when they look at the vine mm-hmm. and they can diagnose it. Is it the same for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a grape whisperer or a vine whisperer. I don't know if you call them that, but you could definitely look at that. And you can see stress levels. You can see, crop load. You can see how the fruit is shaping up. I mean, you can see when the hot days on some vines where there's vertical shoot positioning, some of the grapes have heat stroke, just like we get heat stroke. And then, you know, so the vineyard is alive, and you know, we do so many different passes to it that we nothing comes as a surprise to us. So I wouldn't say nothing. I mean, there's always that, but you know, by carrying and cultivating and doing a lot more passes through the vineyard, whether it's canopy management or shoot thinning or cluster thinning and things like that, you can definitely tell.
There's no substitute for experience.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Care and attention and, you know, touching each vine, looking at each vine. Absolutely.
Who were some of your mentors throughout this experience?
I mean, I think my father, my grandfather, for sure. They were two of my biggest mentors. You know, I look at some people like Mike Trujillo, and I've always, he was at Sequoia Grove for 38 years. Joel Aiken, who was the winemaker after Shell Chef, and I think Shell Chef kind of mentored him. And so, you know, I've taken kind of, you know, hopefully the best of everyone, you know, and try to latch on to what, you know, I can utilize and share with the vines and with other people. So I definitely think those are some of my my influencers.
Excuse me. No, it sounds like you cross-pollinated.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.